A thousand years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser.
Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking, that is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
It's Friday. It's just after 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is, guess who? It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers once more. Well, in the second hour, momentous U-turn as Huawei are booted out of the UK. In 7 years' time, anyway, in 2027. We ask a former GCHQ officer, since they trusted Huawei equipment themselves, both when he was working there and up until a few days ago. That was the official decision. Huawei equipment is trusted. We ask him if there's any real security risk, or is this just what Britain has to do when we're part of the US empire? Also, after Freemason Kemal Atatürk made the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Istanbul a museum, Erdogan turns it back, but into a mosque this time, not a Christian church. What's the reaction of Orthodox Christians? And the reason why Russian Orthodox Church has such strong ties to one of the seven wonders of the world. Professor of Slavic culture Vladimir Goldstein explains what Erdogan is up to. And following up from last week's bombshell about the Phoenicians from Lebanon beating Cabot and Columbus to the new world by about 3,000 years, at least very strong evidence for that. More this week, more evidence, in fact, from Lindsay McCauley over in Australia, who sailed on last December's epic voyage in a replica Phoenician galley over to the Caribbean. He explains the Mayan pyramids link up to the Egyptian pyramids and, believe it or not, Solomon's Temple, which Hiram and the Phoenicians built around about 1000 BC. That's Solomon's original temple. It's the giveaway measurement of the cubit. This is the link he's found between all three. Plus, the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher by MI6 and the CIA explained in a Dispatches documentary, and then the whole industry of investigative journalism for television and radio and in the newspapers pretty much was shut down. A member of the SAS shares more evidence this week that it was the US and the British, not the Libyans, that killed PC Yvonne Fletcher in St. James's Square in cold blood. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, joining me to review this week's news, though, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello there, Tony.
Once more, anything you'd like to highlight this week? Any big issues you think have come up in national or local politics? Because one of the things, obviously, to talk about so straight away, really, is the erection of a statue in Bristol on the plinth of Edward Colston, which has made the headlines around the world. Bristol does seem to be the centre of attention for this whole idea of statues and the slave trade.
Yeah, I mean, I picked up on that, as most Bristolians did. The statue has now been removed by the mayor. It's being held, I understand, in one of the museums. And, you know, discussions are going ahead about what's going to happen to the statue and what's going to happen to the plinth on which the statue was erected. I have to say, the positive thing in Bristol, the only really negative thing that's happened is the destruction of Scipio Africanus's grave in Westbury-on-Trim, which is an act of grotesque vandalism by whoever carried that out. But despite all the ripples and waves that have been caused by this around the world, everything in Bristol has been totally peaceful, and there hasn't been any kind of violence of any kind, apart from...
No, it's all been happening at 5 o'clock in the morning, hasn't it?
Yeah. And, it's pretty sickening because the 1720 grave of Scipio Africanus, who was a slave, obviously, and it's the only slave grave that we've got from that era, and somebody saw fit to go and vandalise it. It's supposedly in revenge for the removal of the Colston statue.
Well, I mean, you and I have been talking about this sort of thing for years. One does wonder, doesn't one, straight away, as if this whole thing is being orchestrated as a way to sort of get people banging heads against each other.
Well, it may be so. I mean, I certainly think in the US you've got people fishing in troubled waters, and ultimately, as we saw in the Gladio structures in Western Europe in the 70s and 80s, the idea is to get both far right and far left at each other's throats so that the state can then legitimately, it would appear, get more power to itself.
I mean, we
I think you've got to be very aware of that.
We talked briefly last week about Leah Hunt Hendricks and her oil baron grandfather, who was one of the conspirators to kill President Kennedy. And we did talk about, you know, that family. She is, Leah Hunt Hendricks is the heiress of that fortune. You know, actually, the family funding both sides. So this sort of thing does happen, and we can document that. So if you don't believe me, check out Leah Hunt Hendricks, who's one of the main funders of Black Lives Matter, and her family has funded things like the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, and the far right as well. So this statue, though, is by Mark Quinn. The statue is of a woman called Jen Reed. But if you have a look at actually who is Mark Quinn, you do wonder if he's just not here being quite a smart, if a devious, wealthy artist and just trying to grab a load of publicity, because it's not a typical one of his statues at all, of his sculptures. A lot of his stuff is extremely sick. When we were talking about basically mutants, he's got an obsession with mutant people who've been dismembered in war. He likes doing statues of them, and people who've been disfigured, say, for example, in the womb and have been mutations, he likes to do statues of them. Plus, he drains his blood, his own personal blood, and he likes mixing it with plasters of Paris. And every 2 years, he makes a new self-portrait based on his own blood. He's also a great mate of Damien Hirst. So he's not short of a bob or two, this Mark Quinn.
No, and of course, the art market is driven by publicity and so on. But of course, you know, artists have always interacted with political movements and vice versa, and no harm was done. And of course, the Marvin made it quite clear that the cost for removing the statue is going to be billed to him. What he and Jen Reed have said is if the statue is sold, that the money should go to various black charities to encourage.
Well, you know, this education. Is a bit like big corporations, isn't it? Of course, this to him is peanuts compared to the fantastic publicity he's got all around the world.
Well, you could compare him to Banksy, except that Banksy's Bristolian. You know, that's what Banksy's been doing for years, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think Banksy does pictures of, like, dismembered war victims and things like that, or does a whole load of kind of sicko portraits in his own blood. I mean, if
well,
you go past if you go past one of Mark Quinn's artworks, it's more likely to turn your stomach than make you laugh, like Banksy. So I don't really agree with your comparison there.
Well, I mean, you like the one and you don't like the other, but that's your privilege, and that's how people react to art, isn't it?
It's not just a personal thing about me, is it? If you go past a statue of a dismembered person, say covered in human blood, that's not going to really do the same for a person as one of Banksy's humorous little artworks, is it?
Well, I haven't done as much research as you've done on this guy. you've obviously have. I didn't even know what sort of things he did apart from this.
I know,
there you go.
See that the local press and Channel 4 News giving him so much mega publicity when it seems to me very obvious that this is just essentially a publicity stunt. But anyway, look, these sorts of things seem to get carry along despite the remnants of the lockdown still being around. And I just thought it was fascinating that this week there was a protest in Thornbury about the lockdown, really. It was sparked, there's a woman called Casey Kendall that organised it, and various people from across the country, around about 100 people attended. She didn't do any publicity for it, even though I sent some messages on to the local media just to say it was taking place. None of them turned up. But I thought I'd have a chat to her about what inspired her to start the protest in the first place. And it turns out that she was just really annoyed to see the pedestrianisation of Thornbury, saying that actually there's friends of hers who run businesses there who are just literally going to have to close down, like takeaways and things like that, because they rely on people being able to drive up, park outside, wait a few minutes and take the stuff away. And she believes that the whole thing was totally unnecessary, as someone who's worked in hospitals and in labs and that sort of thing, and worked with the blood. I don't know exactly what she'll tell us now, what she's worked with. So let's have a listen now to Casey Kendall from Thornbury, who organised the protest last Sunday.
My name's Casey. I've lived in Thornbury for about 2.5 years now. I worked in the Forensic Science Service and I actually used the PCR test. I also worked for 5 years in the NHS as a cytogeneticist. I was studying cells and diagnosing hereditary diseases. So I've got a little bit of lab experience, about 7 years in all.
What's cytogenetics? What's that?
Mm-hmm. So cyto for cell and genetics for the genetic material. So I was analysing chromosome DNA for hereditary diseases, Down syndrome, Edwards syndrome, Lesson-Kefli, Simony. And that was one of my favourite jobs, actually. The thing that sparked off for me was the closure of our high street and just seeing the residents queuing outside shops, watching what they're doing to the high street and just looking on, not knowing what to do, just a feeling of helplessness. And I didn't think that was right. The speakers were absolutely amazing. They came from all over and we had 5 altogether, and it was better than I could ever have dreamt. I've never organized anything like this before. And I know a little bit about a lot of subjects. So what I wanted to do was just show people, especially the people who live in Thornbury who wanted the high street closed, just the bigger picture. I really wanted to put the bigger picture out there. So I invited 5 speakers who all turned up. It was I was a little bit disappointed with the turnout. I was expecting 100 or more, and we had about 70 at tops. But there were plenty of people who walked by, listened for a little bit, and then walked on. And there were plenty afterwards that were asking for additional information, which is really encouraging. Glastonbury also have problems with their high street, and the information she had was really insightful as to the bigger picture and how it affects local people. So she can, if you look at Agenda 21, you can apply that to every single aspect of life. If you learn about it and go and research about that, then everything that comes up, you will see Agenda 21 in it.
Agenda 21 linked to the lockdown then?
So Agenda 21 is the closure of small businesses. They want to run everything on global businesses. The other thing they want is a cashless society. So we're seeing more and more shops now refusing cash and getting you to pay. Of course, we're all desensitized already to paying by card, and some people are paying by watches. So it's not a big step now to have a microchip implant, which they've been doing in America and other countries since 2015, and just swipe in your hand. This way, they control everything. They control, they can keep an eye on data collection is one of the main things. She said the data collection now is going to be one of the main currencies, is they will keep and sell your data, and you will have a social score. So they'll control, if they don't like what you're doing, they just won't put money onto your chip. And there's no other way. You can't do a little job for cash in hand or anything.
That does sound a bit far-fetched, but this sort of thing's already happening in China, isn't it?
It is. And one of the shops that I went to, and this is another thing I was going to say, the shop I used to go to was run by a couple of Chinese ladies. That's shut down. And there's a few charity shops that have already shut down. because of this. And their parents were coming over from China over Christmas. And when I seen them last, I asked about their parents. And she said they bought their ticket, turned up at the airport, and they were told because of their social score, they weren't allowed to fly because they weren't allowed to leave the country. Here and in Australia, even Chinese students are not allowed to speak out against their government because their parents still live in China and they will get the repercussions. And that is exactly where we're heading for.
Well, I think that's pretty shocking to hear. I mean, we're hearing, aren't we, about the US and the Chinese both in tit for tat, usually led by the US, actually, the US initiative, the Chinese expelling or arresting US business people, diplomats, the same the other way around. But, Martin, we're also hearing that. It's the first time, certainly, I've heard that ordinary people are being stopped from travelling out of China. They're not allowed to come out by train. They're not allowed, basically, their passport is invalid. They're not allowed to travel. This reminds me a little bit of, you know, the whole situation in the Cold War with Eastern Europe.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you actually think about it, China at one stage had no foreigners living there at all. A maximum, you know, less than 10 foreigners were allowed into China, and the Chinese people couldn't leave. At the height of the Cultural Revolution, nobody knew what was going on in China, and everybody was basically constantly being observed by the state. So the modern Chinese state, despite its more technological aspect, I mean, they're obviously the kind of mechanisms they now use are much more sophisticated than they used then. But in actual fact, in political terms, it's more liberal than it used to be. That doesn't mean that it's a free society, but you've got to look at these things in historical perspective.
Yeah, but it's closing down again, isn't it? That seems pretty clear between America, Europe, Britain and China, relations are breaking down, diplomatic relations, economic relations, and also just this simply freedom of travel too now.
Well, that's right. But you've got to remember that freedom of travel, I mean, Chinese people didn't travel anywhere at one stage. And now, of course, they go all over the place and their students study all over the world. And of course, Trump is now saying he doesn't want Chinese students in the US. Well, that means they'll study in China, which won't do much good for the bottom line of the universities in the US.
Yeah, and one of the things Casey was saying there is that it's basically the fact that their relatives had been in the UK that meant that the other Chinese actually back in China weren't allowed to travel outside. So this is one of the slightly worrying things about, you know, the track and trace and the increased surveillance due to the lockdown, COVID-19, supposedly, whatever, that we could be moving towards a similar situation that we've been so critical of in China with this social credit score.
Well, I think this is what you said earlier. If there was a more cooperative atmosphere at the top, discussions, for example, between the Western powers and the Chinese about their plans for the developing world, the so-called New Silk Road, Belt and Road Initiative, if democratic Russia was included in the discussions and everybody was rubbing along, then we could have a critical discussion about what and what was not appropriate in terms of social control in the different regions.
But I mean, that's
we're
no,
actually
that's
moving
no
towards
have a lockdown, more extra super surveillance due to the lockdown here, and start gathering more and more people's personal data. Surely,
that's been ongoing.
COVID-19
and the lockdown has increased it.
COVID-19 has been used as an excuse, really, to gather people's data in a similar way to the Chinese do.
Yes, and of course we're actually on the brink of World War III. And as we've said on this show week in, week out, it may well be that this is a biological warfare attack, in which case World War III has definitely started. And one of the things that happens in world wars is, yes, you can get bombed, you can get shot, and you also get the state tends to have more control over what people can and can't do.
Same
in Britain in the Second World War.
Would you compare this then to the Phoney War in 1939 and 1940?
Well, you could. I mean, what's happened is since the 9/11 attack, which of course wasn't carried out by people in caves in Afghanistan, we've become more and more inured to the daily reality that the world is in a massive conflict. And of course, on one stage, one level, we're encouraged to know that we're in conflict, and we've got to, you know, they're all out to get us, and we've got to give the government more power to make sure they can deal with the threats that we face. And at the same time, we're told, just forget about all of that and go shopping, nothing to worry about, life goes on. And of course, it's a massive cognitive dissonance. I mean, since we devastated Iraq in 2003, British people are aware that we're kind of responsible for it, but we've not actually taken responsibility for it. Everybody thinks that we can all just go, well, that was just then. Let's get back to our what we want to do. Time for Brexit, time for the football, time to watch the telly. But of course, in Iraq, they've lost 1 million lives, and on it goes. And there's no end in sight. And that's our fault.
Before we leave the subject of the lockdown, tough new local lockdown powers are in force from tomorrow, says Boris. This is in an announcement earlier today. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced tough new local lockdown powers, which will come into force tomorrow, Saturday. Local authorities will be given the power to close cities or parts of cities or even whole counties in case of local flare-ups of the coronavirus. Central government ministers will also be given tough new rules to act fast to contain the virus. Mr. Johnson unveiled the new powers at a press briefing from Downing Street Friday afternoon. He said local authorities will from tomorrow be able to close premises and outdoor public spaces, cancel events and take other actions to contain the virus in their areas. At the same time, government ministers will be able to close entire sectors in an area such as retail or hospitality, order people to stay at home, stop people entering or leaving an area, restrict public transport and restrict the size of gatherings in an area. This will allow for the rapid creation, apparently, of more local lockdowns. Now, it almost sounds to me like the war on terror. Now we've got the war on the virus, Martin.
Well, yes, but it's not just in Britain, is it? Around the world, some countries have done quite well in controlling this virus. Incidentally, they tend to be the communist ones. That's a bit of a clue. And there's other countries which have done rather badly in controlling the virus and are now flailing around attempting to come up with some kind of viable policy. So we're having a general release of lockdown, but in actual fact, not in Leicester and not probably in lots of other places, because in actual fact, we've lost control of the situation here. Whereas in communist China, with all of their social credit and all the rest of it, they've had less than 4,000 deaths.
Well, my point, you're touching my point there, which is that we're never going to control the virus. The virus is out there. We know it is. It's almost like this could go on for years and years like the war on terror.
Well, it could indeed. What's going to happen is there are going to be clean countries and dirty countries. And the countries like Vietnam, for example, who had 27 deaths, they are basically back to normal. But of course, they can't let people in from outside. Yeah. And they're going to be very careful about who they're doing let in from outside. We, on the other hand, have still got a virus that's just being communicated in the community. And we've basically released the lockdown to try and rescue the economy, even though what's kept the economy going is the furlough money. That's going to end at the end of August. And then there's going to be a massive increase in unemployment. And that's just baked into the pie.
You don't buy any of this, that the lockdown now we're running around about 50 deaths a day, which is minuscule compared to what it was at the peak in April.
We will see, Tony.
You don't buy that at all.
The government may have made the right decision.
Still a big danger, and everything is still, we need to be prepared like we were in April, that there's no chance to release it. Because, I mean, we've had the release going for, 6 weeks or so now, and there certainly hasn't been any massive spike in the cases. It's almost as if, I mean, certainly if you look at the figures, it looks like the pandemic's completely finished.
Well, I think you're being a bit blasé there, but I won't disagree with you. The government has taken these various decisions and we're going to find out whether they work or not. I'm just comparing us with other countries where they've got no virus at all. And of course, we're not one of those countries, are we? And clearly, we made the bit worse decisions at the beginning. As Chris Whitty said this week, I told them to lock down a week before they did. Now, that's 20,000 people dead who wouldn't be dead if they'd done it a week before, but they didn't. And of course, there's a political price to pay for that as well. That's why you've got the government trying to find anybody to blame but themselves.
True, though, Martin, is it? Because one of the things you do with a lockdown is you stretch out the problem. Britain has already had loads and loads and loads of this coronavirus everywhere. By having a lockdown, you just kind of stretch out the cases. You're not in a situation, we haven't been in a situation in Britain probably since maybe November last year where we could have locked down and stopped the virus spreading.
We could have done it. It's becoming pretty clear that when there is a proper investigation and but Boris Johnson, in a slippery way, admitted that there would be. We'll go back over this, and it will become quite clear that the decision to lock down was taken too late in Britain.
Anyway,
not least because people like Dominic Cummings believed in
But you know, nobody even knew that this was going round Britain in December, January, or February.
No, but the decision, it's a time critical decision at the beginning of lockdown. And other countries went quicker and faster, and they were more prepared.
Other countries didn't have it already circulating, with potentially up to 5 million people having caught it by March.
Listen, this will all come out in the wash, Tony.
We shall see.
It may well be that the government's decisions now to have a limited release of lockdown will not lead to a second surge, and they will be proved to be right. I think they're probably wrong.
Some of these so-called surges are based on tests of people, where they go in, they'll test everybody, and they will say, oh gosh, we found loads of coronavirus here, but all of those people are actually asymptomatic. So it does seem amazing that they're doing these lockdowns, even though there is very little spreading. One of the things that's come out this week as well is the tests in France, and now in Germany too, have discovered that there's virtually no a coronavirus being spread within schools. So one does wonder why the schools were locked down in the first place. But look, let's look at Bristol itself, because we've got an unelected mayor this year. The elections were cancelled. Marvin Rees is now in charge. And we have a situation with £10 billion black hole in council budget. So let's have a listen to that. It was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions today.
We now head to Yorkshire and visit Nusshar. Nusshar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the Chancellor said he could not save every job or business. Councils across England are facing a £10 billion black hole, which could see many issue Section 114 notices, effectively declaring bankruptcy. Many councils are already beginning to make severe layoffs. So I ask the Prime Minister, will the Chancellor save local councils? And does he feel that the support his government has already provided is enough for our most vulnerable communities and will not lead to council cuts and another era of austerity?
Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. And in Bradford alone, we've allocated £30 million to help deal with the pressures of the virus. And as I said to the House just now, billions, I think 4.2 billion now, in support for local councils across the country. I pay tribute to the work of local councils and their services for helping us to get through this pandemic, and we will continue to support them.
Well, 4.2 billion, that's quite good, but it's not quite the black hole of 10 billion which exists at the moment, Martin, is it?
Well, it's 6 billion short by definition, isn't it? The point is that they don't like local government, and they're not really prepared to recompense them for all the expenditure that they've carried out.
It seems to me one of the tactics of Boris here, particularly with the big metropolitan Labour areas, is just to bleed them dry of their reserves.
Yeah. That's basically what they're going to do. You can be sure of that. And, of course, that means that the people who live in the most deprived inner city areas are the people who are going to take the most pain as a result of what's happened. And this is always the way, isn't it?
They're like buses. We haven't heard anything from our MPs for God knows how long now. I mean, I listen through the Prime Minister's questions almost every week, and we haven't heard anything from the Bristol MPs for ages. But guess what? Two come along at once this week. On Wednesday, let's start with the Filton and Bradley Stokes Conservative MP, Jack Lopresti, who's talking about jobs, particularly in aerospace in Bristol this week.
Jack Lopresti. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In my constituency of Filton and Bradley Stoke, there are well over 20,000 people directly employed in the aerospace and defence sectors, as well as 17,500 people in the supply chain throughout the South West region. Now, these jobs are not only vital to the individuals and families supported by them, but they are crucial to the economy of our region and our country at large, our future export prospects, connectivity, and our sovereign defence manufacturing capability with programmes like Tempest, the next generation of fighter aircraft. So when will the Prime Minister announce a wide-ranging support package for the aerospace industry, which must include a scrappage scheme for old and highly polluting aircraft?
Prime Minister.
And can I...
No, Prime Minister, come on.
We've got to move on, Mr. Speaker. I'll examine the idea of a scrappage scheme for old and highly polluting aircraft. But what I can tell him is that long before then, we're putting $3.9 billion into the Aerospace Technology Institute. And as I'm sure he knows, the Department of Business, Enterprise and Skills has set up with Transport a joint task force to create Jet Zero, a zero emissions passenger plane in which this company, this country will lead the world.
Okay, zero emissions passenger plane. And Jack Lopressi's cut rather short there. Look, aerospace, Filton, it seems as if it's going down the tubes, Martin.
Well, yeah, and of course, what's actually happening is that the Conservatives have just been converted to the idea of state intervention. What happened to the market? And of course, the market can't function. So the state is going to have to guess what the market's going to look like in a wee while and invest appropriately. Of course, the state isn't prepared to do that because it's not geared up for it. They just presumed the market was going to decide. And the same things, of course, has happened with the nationalisation of railways. Loads and loads of companies at every level of the economy are now dependent on the state. It's like a communist country, isn't it? Except it isn't. Because they haven't got a philosophy that underpins that. They don't know why they're doing it. They're doing it because they've got to do it. But they don't know what they're going to do at the end of it. And, of course, there's no real vision there.
Anyway, look, back to local lockdowns now, because that's the big thing now. You know, there's been a lot of people calling for a bit more autonomy to local areas, local health boards and this sort of thing. But I'm not sure if I'm very comfortable with the idea of our Mayor Marvin Rees deciding if anyone is allowed to move in Bristol or not. Particularly when the southwest has been incredibly low on the national figures, it might just be that he uses these powers in an arbitrary way. And many people have accused him of being a dictator, as any mayor who's elected to that sort of power is able to be basically a dictator. And also, of course, reminding our listeners that he wasn't elected, as many other mayors who were supposed to be elected this year. I mean, it might well be that people of Bristol voted him out, but he's still sitting there, increasing his pay by 12.5%. and running the city, supposedly. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to another local MP, Darren Jones from Bristol, Bristol North West, talking about these local lockdowns.
Darren Jones. Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, on the 23rd of June and again on the 24th of June, the Prime Minister said to the House, in respect of financial support for businesses and workers during local lockdowns, that nobody should be penalised for doing the right thing. Last week, the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy was unable to give any details to my committee at all about this vital future local support. So can the Prime Minister today be crystal clear, for the towns and cities preparing for local lockdowns, will he be penalising businesses and workers for doing the right thing or not?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we've given, in addition to the £160 billion of support that the government has given to people and firms across the country, we've supported areas, cities in lockdown with considerable grants, so £20 million to Leicester, business rates relief for £44 million, £68 million spending on business grants. The best thing possible is for them all to work hard, as Blackburn and Darwin have done, for instance, to get the virus down and to make sure that they're able to open up again.
So, well, we haven't actually had to work very hard, have we? Because we it seems to me, Martin, I don't know whether you agree, that we actually had a high incidence of this COVID-19 in 2019 and in January and February in the southwest. Certainly, I mean, I remember reporting friends of mine at the BBC saying that the Natural History Unit in the 17th of December had a wave of it, several people off work, spreading it around at the BBC. But, of course, the BBC themselves have not reported that fact. And we are now in a situation where these local lockdowns could be sort of happening at any time if the local authorities can actually even afford to do them. So Darren is actually raising some quite important issues there about these new powers.
Well, and of course, you got the same response from Bojo as you got earlier, which is he just gives a list of the money that they're making available. But of course, that money doesn't necessarily cover all the losses of a lockdown. And this is one of the problems with having local lockdowns. You see the same problem in the US. Each local state and each local area has got a different policy.
And
it makes it very difficult for people to know whether they're coming or going, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you may cross the road and find yourself arrested because there's something else going on in a different part of the town. Anyway, the police are definitely not happy with this, and we'll be talking about that in a minute. But the one of the things we talked about, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, was this bizarre side issue to the whole COVID-19 pandemic, which is our medical records being handed over by statute to the National Security Agency in the United States and GCHQ here in Britain. All of our medical history, which is supposed to be private, it's just supposed to be ours, now it's theirs. Well, something even more sinister is going on, and that is now all being handed on to our local authorities. So Marvin Rees can go through my medical records if he wants to, and so can other officials at Bristol City Council. Let's have a listen now to the talk show host, Richie Allen, who does a weekly radio, well, actually daily radio show pretty much, which I appear on from time to time, pointing this out.
Local authorities have been demanding, through people like the Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, they've been demanding, I've been covering this the last few days, it's a bit sinister, this. They want people's data, they want their medical data, to better effectively trace people, to avoid more localised lockdowns. And in the House of Commons the other day, Matt Hancock effectively told Jonathan Ashworth that local councils are getting that data. They are getting personal identifiable data to help them follow people that have maybe tested positive and been told to stay at home so that they can follow up on those people. This really is 1984 now, and I don't say that for effect. I don't say it to be dramatic. But I think it's gotten as bad as it's going to get, and then day by day something else happens that isn't challenged, that isn't opposed by any politician really in the country of any note. And I think, where are we going to be next year? Well, we know, of course, that masks will be introduced in shops in the UK, in England, I should say, by next week, by next Friday, tomorrow week. And I fear, personally, none of that is going to change until they mass produce a vaccine. And I really believe when that happens, that those of us who don't partake in the vaccine will be told that we will be subject to our own personal lockdown of sorts. In other words, well, that's okay, Mr. Adam, but you'll kind of have to hang around your home or as near to it as best you can.
So that's Richie Allen there speaking yesterday. But Martin, this is a bit of a worry, isn't it? I mean, it seems we've completely lost control of our personal private data. It's just slid away, and now it's being handed over to local authorities too, and goodness knows where else. I mean, we do know actually that the intelligence services, once they've got it, that there is actually quite a lot of evidence that they then sell it on to big corporations. In fact, there's been a big drive from central government to get more of the big transnational corporations to cooperate and work very closely with the intelligence services too.
Well, yes, and Dominic Cummings, of course, is very keen on the idea that these AI companies, like the ones set up by Peter Thiel, should have access to NHS data. And in fact, they've been given it. And this is, you know, if you give your data to the NHS, that's a government thing. It's supposedly got checks and balances in it. We all know what's supposed to be going on. It's a public body. But these private companies, AI companies, have been given access to all the data, and they say that they're not going to use it. They're not going to abuse that. But of course they are, and of course they're linked to the intelligence services. A lot of the intelligence services work is in fact subcontracted to these various AI companies. It's very sinister. And the COVID-19 crisis has brought it forward.
I mean, it looks to me as if the pandemic is being used as an excuse for the rich and powerful, particularly corporate power and the banksters, to get away with a whole load of stuff that they wanted to do anyway.
Well, it's what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism, isn't it? Never let a good crisis go to waste. They wanted to go in these kind of directions anyway, and this gives them the carte blanche to do it. And of course, the problem is that there is some legitimate reason to collate this kind of data when you're dealing with something like this. But of course, we don't trust the pharmaceutical companies, the intelligence services. or the government to manage this effectively, or you know, they're not to be trusted with it. Who is going to guard the guardians?
Yeah, a bit annoying for Jonathan Ashworth to be pushing for this. But anyhow, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, where he was starting to look ahead a little bit and at this autumn and this winter with the way that the lockdown is going to be eased and the potential for problems to come.
Keir Starmer.
The Prime Minister knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's the rehiring 30,000 people at BA on worse terms and conditions, and he should call it out. Yesterday, the government's expert advisory group published a report on the challenges this autumn and winter. They were asked to do so by the government's Office for Science. That report assessed the reasonable worst-case scenario for this autumn and winter, including a second COVID spike and seasonal flu. And it set out strong recommended actions to mitigate the risks. The report was clear. July and August must be a period of intense preparation, i.e. now. Can the Prime Minister make clear that he intends to implement the recommended actions in this report in full and at speed?
Prime Minister, not only are we getting on with implementing the preparations for a potential new spike, but he will know that the government is engaged in record investments in the NHS, £34 billion. What I think the House may not realise is just in the last year since this government has been in office, there are now 12,000 more nurses in the NHS, 6,000 more doctors, and it was thanks to their hard work, thanks to the hard work of the entire NHS, that we were able to prevent our health service from being overwhelmed this spring, and we will take steps to ensure that it is not overwhelmed this winter as well.
Starmer.
That's the whole point of this report. Exactly. It sets out the reasonable worst case scenario and tells the government what it needs to do about it. So I'm surprised he's not committing to fully implement it.
Well, I'm not surprised. Oh, Boris is so full of bluster, Martin, isn't he?
Well, he is. And, you know, we could talk about the pandemic and what needs to be done. But more, you know, it's probably more constructive to talk about the politics around all of this.
Well, yeah, but why is Starmer telling Boris that you must cater for the worst case scenario? Well, we tried to do that with the massive initial lockdown and the putting up all these hospitals that were never used and that sort of thing. It seems quite obvious to me that you shouldn't be catering for the worst case scenario. You should be catering for the most likely scenario.
Well, you may say that. Starmer is trying to kebab him, saying, will you fulfil the report, the recommendations in this report? We didn't actually hear what they were. So it's hard to come to, a conclusion.
I'm sure what he's suggesting is that we need to have very harsh lockdown measures in order to stop a second spike. But
I don't know that that's what that report says, but it may or may not.
The thing that they're pushing, effectively, is they're saying, oh, you know, the economy can go hang. We need to just make sure we don't get a second spike. But that could be a form of paranoia.
Well, it could be. But the real problem, Tony, is that the economy is stuffed anyway. If COVID disappeared tomorrow morning, the economy would still be stuffed.
The only way to sort this out, really, is going to be with government control of the Bank of England, surely, making sure that the
government does control the Bank of England. In theory, it's an independent central bank, but it's not a private bank like the Federal Reserve. And there's a very interesting article this week in the New Statesman about the response of the Bank of England and the Treasury to the crisis. And of course, Andrew Bailey just came into his job the week the crisis broke, and they've obviously briefed the reporter who wrote the article. I can't remember the name of him. It's a long, in-depth article involving lots of interviews with Andrew Bailey and other financial civil servants.
I just think we should put a link up to that on our show page at this week.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's in the New Statesman. You can read one article in the New Statesman every month without paying. So if that's the one to read, read that one, because it's quite a long article. And they are very, very scathing about the government's response, very scathing about Dominic Cummings. And in fact, they're being very pretty hostile. And that's probably because they feel that the Treasury and the Bank of England have got sufficient clout to face him down.
Maybe it'd be an equivalent article in The Spectator saying the opposite.
Well, the point is that the Bank of England staff have clearly decided that they're going to brief this guy from the New Statesman. And they're on the record of saying all sorts of things.
Look, hang on a minute, because a lot of those people will be a bit like Corbyn, having to suffer in the Labour Party with all the people Blair appointed. They will be Carney appointees, won't they, a lot of them?
Well, they're basically career civil servants, and they've worked in that field.
I mean,
they're not at all.
Oh. Isn't there a purge of the civil service going on at the moment?
Well, that's right. And of course, what they are doing, the rest of the civil service, Mark Sedwill, who's the head of the civil service, he's been thrown out the window by Cummings, who himself should have been thrown out the window, if you remember. He only escaped his own job by the skin of his teeth, but he's now raging around like Genghis Khan, getting rid of people who've been there for years.
He can't do that
in the Bank of England.
Surely what's happening here is exactly what should have happened when Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party, is that you've got a new government under Boris and they are fed up with all these very biased civil servants that were appointed by Cameron and Theresa May as basically, you know, a completely different new generation coming in now.
Well, you've got to recognise, Tony, that in the US, when anybody wins an election, even at local level, for parish level, any level, then they sack everybody that was previously employed and they bring all their own people in. We've never done it like that in this country. We have a professional civil service which serves, which means that you've got continuity. Can you imagine the chaos if every time we had an election in Bristol, everybody that was employed by the council was sacked and a whole load of new people were brought in?
You can
do it like that, but it's a way to do it.
That is exactly what happened when Marvin Rees turned up at the council. He got rid of all of the senior people, all their experience and local knowledge, and brought in a load of pro-corporate types.
Well, this is a constant battle at any level of politics. Are you going to have permanent people? I mean, for example, British ambassadors in the Foreign Office are professional diplomats. They have a career path and all the rest of it. US ambassadors are basically big funders of whoever the political party in charge is, and they get a job to go and represent Britain, US in Germany or wherever. But they've got no diplomatic skills at all. They just go around there and basically they often insult the locals and create all kinds of problems.
Anyway,
but that doesn't happen in the British Foreign Office.
Apparently coming in 10 days or so's time, everyone's got to wear a mask. It doesn't matter. You can have a swastika on your mask if you want to. You're allowed to do that in this country. Whether or not it's actually good for you is another question. There's lots of reports out there, in fact, some from the World Health Organization themselves, that say that the masks are really a bad idea if you've got certain conditions, and even if you haven't, that they actually reduce your oxygen content, and others saying that effectively what they do is when you've got a mask on, you tend to touch it more, and therefore you're bringing potential contamination up to your face because you're wearing a mask. But anyway, there's all sorts of contention about whether this is an enforceable rule or not. So let's have a listen now to the Metropolitan Police Federation Chair, Ken Marsh, talking on the Today programme on Tuesday morning.
Ken Marsh, Chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation. Good morning, Mr. Marsh.
Good morning.
How enforceable do you think this is going to be for your officers? Because you'll have heard Peter Cowgill saying there, this is not a matter for shop security, it's a matter for the police.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two strands to what you've just said. Firstly, shopkeepers need to step up to the plate and take some responsibility. They can quite easily put signs up on their doors, no mask on, no entry, this is private property. That's the first point that, you know, we need to get across, because this cannot all be laid on the shoulders of the police yet again. The second point is it will be nigh on impossible for enforcement, because you won't have a police officer on every shop door, because there isn't enough of us. If a shopkeeper calls the police because someone hasn't got a mask on, they have no power to detain them, so that person can just walk away. We'll be driving round and round London looking for people who weren't wearing masks. It's absolutely absurd.
But most people are compliant, aren't they? That's certainly the evidence from transport in London, that there's about 90% compliance.
I would question the 90% compliance on public transport, having been on it and seen myself what's taking place. But you're quite right. A huge amount of the British public are completely compliant. But there are a lot of people who are just not interested, do not want to wear one, and will become very cantankerous when they are told to do so.
And they will then, that will place your officers in a difficult position?
Absolutely. It's It's a more than a difficult position. It becomes a position where it is them and us yet again. And we've seen this throughout this COVID pandemic. It has always become the police's problem to deal with this.
That's because it's the police's job to enforce the law and regulations.
Not on private property. If someone's not doing what someone privately owns their property for, it isn't the police's problem to deal with it. I think you'll find under legislation. But, you know, the issue here is, how do we deal with this collectively rather than making it just the police's problem to deal with? And the legislation that's come out has laid it fully on the police's shoulder. And as I said to you at the beginning, shopkeepers can take some responsibility by signage, etc., to explain.
So that's Ken Marsh, Chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation, Martin. I mean, it sounds like a bit of ping-pong, really. The shopkeeper's saying it's the police's job. The police are saying, well, that's absurd. We can't be everywhere at once.
Yeah, well, you can see there are no good options in these kind of circumstances. In some cultures, the wearing of masks, for example, in Hong Kong, because they've had SARS and all these other outbreaks, people wear masks, they just do it. In some cultures, it's just not, you know, you can see there's a split within the British population where I live around here. So, some people are wearing masks, certainly most of the shopkeepers are, but lots of people aren't. If it's compulsory, I've got one, I will wear it if it's required. We just, you know, people rowing and arguing about this are not helping themselves or anybody else, really.
But he's saying it's absurd.
He's saying that the police can't be made responsible for policing it. That's a perfectly legitimate point of view coming from his point of view. If we were going, what the question has to be is, if we're going to be wearing masks from next Friday, why weren't we doing it already? And of course, that's the trouble with the response of the government from the very beginning.
Yeah,
there was
going to be
herd immunity,
and then the figures suggest that
we're going to wear masks, and then we are.
Especially since the figures suggest that the pandemic is over, and also that the vast majority of people, we're talking about at least 70-80% of people, aren't actually that vulnerable to this anyway. And it's surely up to people to take their own responsibility. Anyway, this will be very interesting to see how this all plays out, the mask business. And I suggest that, I mean, you know, the BBC have been talking about, 40% of people wear masks. Well, when I was in Gloucester at the weekend, it was interesting to watch, to look around. I spent 3 hours hobbling around Gloucester. I didn't see a single person wearing a mask. So I would say that
you're not supposed to wear them outdoors anyway.
Is it around about 1%?
That would be the explanation, wouldn't it?
1%.
You're not supposed to wear them when you're in a shop or you're on public transport.
Yeah, but this is even in the shopping centres and things like that.
Well, they don't have to wear them in the shopping centres. From Friday next, they will.
Not a single person did I see, and yet the BBC are reporting 40% of people in public spaces are wearing masks. It's just not true. As Ken Marsh is saying, you know, there's the BBC saying that 90% of people on buses, he's saying that's not what he's seen. So we're seeing a lot of misreporting as well. But anyway, I thought it would be useful to have a listen to, I think, a marvellous old doctor. His name's Vernon Coleman. He's been doing a whole series of recordings on these the effects of this pandemic. I first came across him, gosh, must be about 1996, as a book that he'd written called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And he was a doctor who was extremely skeptical, like Andrew Wakefield, for example, about the pharmaceutical industry, saying, well, look, this is a predatory industry. They're actually trying to make people sick so that they can get them dependent on their products and satisfy their shareholders. So let's have a listen now to Vernon Coleman now. His idea, of course, is, and most doctors should be, to do no harm. But he says, actually, that they're now starting to get into a mode where elderly people begin to be expendable.
How have we managed to forget that in the 1930s, the Nazis deliberately starved and dehydrated elderly and vulnerable patients because they were regarded as a useless burden on society? That's exactly what we're doing today. We're killing people off if they're old and can't complete an Ironman triathlon. The government has already given doctors the legal right to kill old people by starving them to death or depriving them of fluids if they're filling a hospital bed that the administrators want to use for a patient requiring cosmetic surgery or infertility treatment. So what's the next step? Well, the next obvious step is to kill off all sorts of patients with chronic or potentially expensive illnesses such as cancer and heart disease. How on earth could you do that? How could the politicians possibly get the voters to put up with that? Well, you could shut down the hospitals on the excuse that they're needed for the 8 million patients expected to fall ill with the coronavirus. It would be like introducing the death penalty by the back door. But we won't be killing the possibly guilty, we'll be killing the definitely innocent. You couldn't do that, of course, though, could you? Of course you could. And they have. In the UK, there'll be soon 10 million people awaiting hospital appointments and treatment. Nearly 2.5 million are currently waiting for treatment for cancer. Hospital departments are still shut because of social distancing, although there's absolutely no reason at all for it. We don't shut hospitals when there's a flu epidemic. And let me remind you, this is not as bad as a flu epidemic. What if it was all part of a plan to get rid of people who need treatment? What would you call it when a government decides to kill millions of patients who might need care and cost money? Genocide, perhaps? Is it part of the complete reset of our world, as talked about and enthused over by Prince Charles and company at the World Economic Forum? Why have things changed so much? Well, it's partly money, and it's partly eugenics. Bill Gates used to be very keen on eugenics, so I hear. It's all part of a wider plan.
So that's Dr. Vernon Coleman. He hasn't been thrown out by the General Medical Council yet, the author of the book, How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. I find his talks quite refreshing, Martin. We're certainly not going to be hearing him on the BBC. But he's saying, well, actually, you know, the effect of this, there's millions of people who are simply not getting treatment on the NHS at the moment. This is like a giant cull.
Yeah, but of course he's then going on to say this is a plan. Now, it may be a plan, but whose plan is it? If it's a plan, Steve Bannon and others think it's a Chinese biowarfare attack on the West. I don't think it's a Chinese biowarfare attack on the West. I think it's a Western biowarfare attack on China, which has the secondary effect of killing off loads of old people, as he says. And of course, ultimately, that could be the eugenicist agenda behind all of this. And what are we going to do about it? Well, the point is denying that there is anything such, you know, that the pandemic is a physical reality. It's not just in the mind. And of course, this you've got to start really talking about psychological warfare, World War III, and all the rest of it.
You know, you saying in the present tense, the pandemic is a reality. I think, you know, we could be talking about this all night, Martin, but I'm going to put on our show page at thisweek.org.uk those NHS figures again. When you look at the graph, I mean, it's basically banged down against the axis again. It's been right up high, but now we're banging against the axis. But look, I don't want to labour that point, but I will put that up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it would be useful, I think, to have a listen to a general analysis of this whole idea about vaccines, because this seems to be the direction that we're heading. And this is a talk. It's basically a meeting that Del Bigtree, he's the director of the film Vaxxed, which, if you remember, we had an extract a couple of years ago when it first came out. And there's been all sorts of attempts to stop this film being shown. And it's largely features Andrew Wakefield, the so-called discredited Andrew Wakefield, talking about the dangers of the modern vaccination industry. Now, I just want to stress that he's not against all vaccines. None of them are. But he's saying that the vaccine industry is turning into a giant monster that wants to inject us with any old rubbish in order to make money. So let's have a listen now to Del Bigtree in a pre-COVID speech about vaccines.
People need to know. Yeah. Not a single childhood vaccine has ever been tested against an inert placebo. They never admitted that until we challenged them on it. In that meeting, we said we cannot find any double-blind inert placebo study for a single one of the 16 childhood vaccines that we give our children. Are they not being done, or are you not showing them, or are we looking at the wrong websites? Because we've read every single scientific piece of information from our government and from the manufacturers. At first, one of the scientists said, oh, we do double-blind experiments. They're just in early trial phases. And we said, fine, we're sitting at the National Institute of Health. Please bring those in right now because right. they would be here. They couldn't provide that. And then Tony Fauci, head of infectious disease, said, we don't do double-blind experiments with placebos because it would be unethical. So our medical establishment has decided that it's unethical to have a placebo group, and therefore not a single childhood vaccine has ever established a safety control. We don't know if they're safe. There's no way to say they're safe. Essentially, we decided in this country and around the world that it's more ethical to give a product that's never been through a safety study to every child in the country. Now what they'll say is, well, we've been running it for a very long time, and it's proven to be safe. Well, really, we have the sickest generation of children this country has ever seen. We have seen the largest decline in public health in history. We have gone from 12.8% chronic illness, so neurological or autoimmune diseases in the 1980s, before we took liability away, when we were getting 10 vaccines. Then we took liability away from the industry. They could no longer be sued if their products injured anyone. And now, in 2019, we're giving 72 vaccines, and our chronic illness rate in our children is 54%. We've gone from 12 to 54% chronic illness. That means neurological disorders in 1 in 6 of our children. 1 in 7 has a speech delay. 1 in 4 is leaving elementary school on a drug they're going to be on the rest of their lives. The point being, this is the greatest crash in public health we've ever seen. We have more babies dying on the first day of life than every other industrialized nation combined. These are all facts. I can back them up. I'll show a lot of them are cited here. We have more babies dying in the first year of life than the 20 other richest nations in the world. And we're now reporting we're 70% more likely to die before reaching 18 in America than the 20 other richest nations. What is the reason for this? Well, there's two things that I think people say, well, you're saying vaccines are doing all of that. We now have science that's happening all over the world that's showing how vaccines are definitely contributing to the problem. But here's the point. Should we be listening to health departments? Should we be making laws based on recommendations from a health department that has overseen the greatest decline in public health in world history? I think that we really need to look twice. And I would urge any politician to say, I want to see the science from the other side. They keep saying there's thousands of studies that show that vaccines don't cause autism. Thousands of, we've read them. They're not there. Those science studies do not exist. They are not there. There are 14 total studies looking at autism, and half of them are on the MMR vaccine and the other on thimerosal. When they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism, they have only looked at one vaccine out of 16 vaccines. Most parents are complaining that the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and the Institute of Medicine looked into it, and you know what they found? Not a single study has ever looked at the comparison of autism and the DTaP vaccine. They said, we can neither confirm nor deny whether the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and that's what's cited by the CDC. That study is what they cite when they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism. That's a fraud. That's a fraud being perpetrated by the CDC. And so the warning that I would be giving from your team to everyone else is, you can be the first Nazi in, and throughout history, when we start book burning, when we start censoring speech, when we start using bullying tactics to move society instead of information and science, we know we're coming to our end. And we don't want to see the government fail. We do not want to see oppression. And by the way, this oppression, laws like this, taking away this exemption, is making our movement explode. Mm-hmm. It is exploding. Mm-hmm. And measles is exploding, because what would you do if you were told you were going to be quarantined from being able to be in a synagogue on Passover? You'd say, let's go ahead and get the measles out of the way right now so that we can never be quarantined again. They are causing what they call an epidemic. How do you call something an epidemic when everyone in it is trying to get the measles? That's what's happening. Right. No one's running from it. This is not Ebola.
No, 5,000.
Right. I have to go get your vaccine this week. You're going to say, hold on a second, I've been healthy for 15 years without a vaccine, and so is every adult in this country. So they're going to remove the exemptions before they bring the adult mandate. The pharmaceutical industry isn't the number one most powerful lobby in Washington, outspending oil and gas simply because they want to waste time in Washington. They have one product, the vaccine industry, that cannot be sued, doesn't have to go through safety studies, so there's no cost on this product. There's no risk on this product. We have 72 vaccines now, 270 have been approved, and thousands are in trials as we speak. The future of this industry is vaccines, and every politician they can buy to force more vaccines into the population, they're going to make money. But the moment the adult mandate comes, I assure you, pharma's not fighting for the 2% of the unvaccinated kids. They want 320, 40 million Americans, wherever we're at right now, indentured to a program that will turn the pharmaceutical industry from a billion-dollar industry, $50 billion they're making from vaccines right now, into a trillion-dollar industry overnight. That is what is taking place, yeah. And it is people like you and great politicians that are protecting us right now, yeah. As they should, from one of the most dangerous industries that has paid out over $30 billion in damages for having killed us with products they knew were dangerous.
So that's the director of Vaxxed, Dale Bigtree, there, speaking before the lockdown, actually, about vaccines. But Martin, he's painting a pretty scary picture there. Of the biggest lobby in Washington having completely captured and controlled regulation of their own industry to the extent where the Center for Disease Control is using expressions like, we neither confirm nor deny whether this vaccine is safe.
Yeah, well, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is clearly, not on the side of the angels and never has been. Ivan Illich, the social thinker, wrote a book which came out in 1964, I think, called Medical Nemesis. And, of course, the underlying all of this is that it's all done for private profit. It isn't done for private profit in countries like Cuba.
Also, I mean, you mentioned there, didn't he? Dale mentioned this whole thing of people not being able to sue a vaccine company if they're damaged by a vaccine. Now, of course, this takes on a much more sinister aspect if you're forced to have their vaccine, and then if it damages you, kills one of your loved ones, you can't sue. Suddenly it all becomes very, very nasty. And this started back in the 1980s. That's when the pharmaceutical industry managed to get this law through in the US. You couldn't sue the pharmaceutical industry. Actually, it would be the US government you would have to sue. And, of course, the government are not going to find against themselves, are they? Let's have a listen now to this extract from the 60 Minutes documentary, which was done in 1976, just after the swine flu epidemic, looking at the effects that the vaccines for the swine flu had had on people, which are pretty horrific. And also, Martin, as you might not be entirely surprised, the breakout of swine flu in the 70s started with the military.
Yeah, just as the 1918 Spanish flu began on a military base in Kansas.
Fascinating.
Probably as a result of vaccinations.
Extract from the 60 Minutes documentary now.
Remember the swine flu scare of 1976? That was the year the U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a killer that could spread across the nation. And Washington decided that every man, woman, and child in the nation should get a shot to prevent a nationwide outbreak, a pandemic. Well, 46 million of us obediently took the shot. And now 4,000 Americans are claiming damages from Uncle Sam amounting to $3.5 billion because of what happened when they took that shot. By far the greatest number of the claims, two-thirds of them, are for neurological damage or even death, allegedly triggered by the flu shot. We pick up the story back in 1976 when the threat posed by the swine flu virus seemed very real indeed.
This virus was the cause of a pandemic in 1918 and 1919 that resulted in over 500,000 deaths in the United States, as well as 20 million deaths around the world.
See how easy it is to...
Thus, the U.S. government's publicity machine was cranked into action to urge all America to protect itself against the swine flu menace.
Influenza is serious business. During major flu epidemics, millions of people are sick and thousands die. Well, this year you can get protection. The vaccines are safe, easy to take, and they can protect you against flu. So roll up your sleeve. Protect yourself.
One of those who did roll up her sleeve was Judy Roberts. She was perfectly healthy, an active woman, when in November of 1976, she took her shot. 2 weeks later, she says, she began to feel a numbness starting up her legs.
I joked about it at that time. I said, I'll be numb to the knees by Friday if this keeps up. By the following week, I was totally paralyzed.
So completely paralyzed, in fact, that they had to operate on her to enable her to breathe. And for 6 months, Judy Roberts was a quadriplegic. The diagnosis? A neurological disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS for short. These neurological diseases are little understood. They affect people in different ways. As you can see in these home movies taken by a friend, Judy Roberts' paralysis confined her mostly to a wheelchair for over a year. But this disease can even kill. Indeed, there are 300 claims now pending from the families of GBS victims who died, allegedly as a result of the swine flu shot. In other GBS victims, the crippling effects diminish and all but disappear. But for Judy Roberts, progress back to good health has been painful and partial.
Now, I notice that your smile, Judy, is a little bit constricted.
Yes, it is.
Is it different from what it used to be?
Very different. I have a greatly decreased mobility in my lips. And I can't drink through a straw on the right-hand side. I can't blow out birthday candles. I don't whistle anymore, for which my husband is grateful.
It may be a little difficult for you to answer this question, but have you recovered as much as you are going to recover?
Yes, this is it.
So you will now have a legacy of braces on your legs for the rest of your life?
Yes, the weakness in my hands will stay and the leg braces will stay.
So Judy Roberts and her husband have filed a claim against the U.S. government. They're asking $12 million, though they don't expect to get nearly that much.
Judy, why did you take the flu shot?
I'd never taken any other flu shots, but I felt like this was going to be a major epidemic. And the only way to prevent a major epidemic of a really deadly variety of flu was for everybody to be immunized.
Where did this so-called deadly variety of flu, where did it first hit back in 1976? It began right here at Fort Dix in New Jersey in January of that year when a number of recruits began to complain of respiratory ailments, something like the common cold. An Army doctor here sent samples of their throat cultures to the New Jersey Public Health Lab to find out just what kind of bug was going around here. One of those samples was from a Private David Lewis who had left his sickbed to go on a forced march. Private Lewis had collapsed on that march, and his sergeant had revived him by mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. A few days later, Private Lewis died.
So, again, Martin, the military being the source of that outbreak in the United States, it's starting to get a bit of a regular pattern, this, isn't it?
Yeah, well, as you know, the sort of alternative history of the 1918 epidemic was that it began on a military base in Kansas, and they'd all just been inoculated against flu before they went off to the Western Front. Wilson, who was the president at the time, was told what was going on, but they didn't tell anybody what was happening because they didn't want to upset the war effort. And the reporting of it only came out in Spain because Spain wasn't involved in the First World War and therefore didn't have military censorship. And so, ultimately they treated it as if it was an accidental outbreak, but they kept it quiet anyway. And of course, the suspicion is that it was accidental. I don't think they deliberately intended to set off the outbreak, but they were using vaccines and they were cutting corners because it's wartime and we've got to get the boys into the trenches as quick as possible. The vaccine's going to help. Similarly, in the run up to the first Gulf War,
loads of injections
for the soldiers involved, which had devastating consequences.
Absolutely, that's Gulf War syndrome for you. Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing is that using the wartime censorship to cover up the source of the actual Spanish flu, very convenient.
Yeah, and I think there is an interaction between militarization, authoritarianism, big pharma. It's probably a more complex relationship than a straightforward plot.
I mean, you've just got
the interaction of all these negative forces.
I was hearing basically there's two new buildings just being built at Porton Down, so obviously expansion of their activities, even though they're not supposed to exist. So is it possible that they've been involved somehow in creating this virus?
Well, we're coming to the nitty-gritty here. Whether the Wuhan virus, as the right wing in the US and Australia have taken to calling it, whether it started in Wuhan, B, whether it's just a virus like other viruses, or whether it came from this particular research center. But of course, they were doing work for DARPA, which is the Dominic Cummings is very keen on DARPA, and they were both in the West and in the East. They've been looking at bat coronaviruses. Now they're looking at them because they may become a threat, you know, just because they're out there in the environment, or because somebody may weaponize them. Now, I don't know whether this is a weaponized virus or not. We discussed this week in, week out.
It's a famous Nature magazine article from the end of last year, which is calling them out, what they're up to, saying, well, actually, what you're trying to do is you're trying to see if you can get bat coronaviruses and other animal ones to jump to humans. And this is completely ridiculous and unnecessary research. You've got to stop it immediately.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are scores, if not hundreds, of labs doing this kind of work. They're funded by DARPA. They're funded by the Pentagon. They're not funded by the health department. So they're definitely weaponizing viruses and looking at what they can do with them. And we know that they've used these kind of biological weapons against Cuba and against Eastern Europe and against North Korea. The Colorado beetle was dropped all over them to kill off their potatoes. They've been looking into this ever since the end of the Second World War. And this could very well be what we're going through is the ultimate what ultimately happens.
Anything important down, which I think personally it might well be, the government committee that will be looking into it is the Intelligence and Security Committee. Not that they actually really delve too deep. They seem to be a little bit afraid to do that. We've had a bit of a debacle this week, haven't we, with Chris Grayling having lost his race to be chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, having been that being taken over by Tory Julian Lewis. Instead, he's managed to sort of scupper Boris's plans to put Grayling in charge, with a bit of help from Labour.
Yeah, and I was talking about this on RT yesterday. Yes, and it's quite interesting. I mean, Grayling is one of the, you know, he's regarded as one of the least competent cabinet ministers ever, and the idea of putting him in charge of the security committee, where he's got no background in that whatsoever. I think what his job was to do was
to... Well, that's perfect. Martin, that's perfect for the...
Well, of course, yes. Absolutely. In a way, that's absolutely perfect. And what his job was to do... There's apparently this report on Russian interference in British politics, which has been under wraps for a long time. And Grayling, I think, was supposed to keep it under wraps. I can't imagine what's in it. No doubt we're going to find out. But, of course, there's another report that was done when the Lib Dem Conservative coalition was in power into who funds Islamic extremism in Britain. And that's never been released either, because, again, what that probably shows is our good friends, the Saudis, the ones who we got training at Sandhurst and our boys are cooperating with in Yemen. They're the funders of Islamic extremism. But we've got a government report about that, but we're not allowed to see it. I don't know what's in this Russian report. It may be that what's in the report that they don't want to come out is the relationship between various Russian oligarchs and the Tory party. And these Russian oligarchs aren't necessarily pro-Putin. They're just rich. The Tory party gets money from all sorts of people, rich people. Some of them are Russians. That may be what they don't want to come out.
OK, let's just have a look at this guy anyway, Julian Lewis. I hadn't really heard of him before. He's now in the chair of that committee with a very powerful role. If he steps in the wrong direction, he might find himself falling in the River Thames. He's been voting, Martin, for the use of UK military force in combat operations overseas consistently. He consistently voted for the Iraq war, and he generally voted for investigations, though, into the Iraq war afterward. And he wants a replacement for Trident with a new nuclear weapons systems. He's fairly anti-EU, but not totally anti-EU, he is voted against military action against ISIL, which I suppose is a reasonably good sign. But I suppose most Tories anyway would be that kind of voting record, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and of course he's no longer a Tory, because even though this wasn't a whipped matter, he voted for himself to be on.
Yeah, it certainly sounds as if he's going to be a bit more independent mining.
Yeah, and he's obviously as far as MI6 and the military are concerned, he's an insider. So we shall see.
Well, look, talking about the military, we have to announce the death of a friend of this programme we've had on several times. His name is Ian Matteson. He was a major in the British Army before he retired. And in fact, he was brought back, I think, over the Afghanistan back into the army. He was in the reserves for a while. And the interesting thing about Ian is that he was a Freemason who was very clear about talking about exactly what that meant. And he did an interview with me about 18 months ago about the series that Sky News had done about the Freemasons, which I thought was quite entertaining. He was saying it looked to him as if it had been commissioned and produced by Freemasons themselves, even though it was supposed to be an investigation of the Freemasons. A bit cheeky of Sky to do that. So I thought we'd have a little listen now to a clip of Ian talking about the use of the skull and the crossbones in the ceremonies of the Freemasons, which is, he confirmed it definitely does happen. One of the things I remember him saying to me, Martin, was how bizarre it was to have his own father press a point of a dagger towards his heart, threatening his life, when he was first initiated into the Masonic lodge that he took over from his father. He was then later booted out of that lodge. I mean, obviously, this is a cult. It's a religious cult. And to have these sorts of ceremonies does make you think that anybody in public office or in any powerful office at all is much more loyal to their cult than they are to you and I. But let's have a listen to Ian Matteson now.
The skull and crossbones is shown in the third degree ceremony because it's all to do, and there's a sort of a makeshift grave, or in some lodges there's an actual coffin for the body to be lowered into. That's you, the candidate, the body. And this is to reflect on your mortality. As we say, the story of Hiram Abiff, the chap who's the architect of it, well, actually it shows, and you enact out the killing of him and then the raising of him afterwards. Back to life. Well, actually, he doesn't come back to life. He raises you up, and from the way he's raised up, are the third degree secrets are then revealed to a master mason. But they're purely parts of mortality, as you and I would see. You've seen skull and crossbones on pirate ships, you've seen skull and crossbones in churches, etc.
Well, hang on a minute, because also the skull and crossbones were on the peaks of the caps of all the SS Nazis in the Second World War. It's also a symbol involved in black magic too. I mean, it does seem as if there is a bit of a negative connotation to this, and yet the Masons seem to embrace it.
Yeah, they want to embrace it, yes. But, I mean, one of the things about the Masons is that, I mean, again, go back to the first degree. When you're given your obligation, you're given a what's known as a sign, a token, and a word. And the sign is given, and I don't know if you want to do the gesture, but if you open your right hand and stick your left thumb out at right angles to it, and then draw it across your throat from your left ear to your right ear, and then bring it down to your side, that is the token of a Mason, first degree, although it is, it's always the basic one. And it's symbolic of you having your throat cut across, because that's what you agree should happen to you if you give up the secrets of Freemasonry. The token, as they say, or the handshake, as everybody knows, is a particular one. As in first degree, you'll press the knuckle of the first finger of the other guy's hand, and so on and so forth. And the word, which is a token of word, is taken straight from the Holy Bible. There's nothing, there's no extra words here and there thought up or whatever. They're taken straight out of the Holy Bible, as is the Fellowcraft is taken, the story of the building of King Solomon's temple. And here we are now back within taking stories out of the Holy Bible or the Christian Bible or whatever you want to call it. And yet it's applied to what they've called, and in the program, they says, we are a secular society. Bit of odds there, aren't they?
Yes, well, he's pointing out the hypocrisy, really, in the Sky programme about the Freemasons. But that's lovely to hear the voice of Ian Matteson, who passed away a couple of weeks ago in one of his family, anyway, called suspicious circumstance. He was in very good health and just passed away. Basically, he was out cycling. But Martin, this is actually links up in a weird way, doesn't it, with the stuff we were talking about, we'll be doing a bit more later, about the Phoenicians, because Hiram Abiff was a Phoenician, and it was him that built Solomon's Temple in the first place, and a lot of the Masonic imagery links back to that.
Well, it does in the minds of those who've developed Masonic imagery. I mean, they're obviously they believe in Hermes Trismegistus or whatever it is. Basically, a lot of this stuff is 18th century antiquarianism. And, of course, they believe that they got this stuff originally from ancient Egypt and so on.
The Masons would say 17th century, but if you look at it, people like Elias Ashmole, he admits to have being initiated into a Masonic lodge back in the mid-1600s. So, you know, it goes back a way.
Yeah, it does, but it doesn't go back to ancient Egypt. They didn't know much about ancient Egypt in those days, but they wanted to have an ancient... venerable tradition, but it basically, like a lot of things, it's a created tradition.
You know what?
The tartans in Scotland were an invention of the 19th century.
You reminded me a bit about the Stonehenge Druids, because I think there's been a sort of reinvention of that. The complete rebuilding of Stonehenge back in the 1920s and the late 1940s. The whole Stonehenge was completely rebuilt. But anyway, look, I think there's just one more story I'd like to look at before we go to some music. And that is that the data, the US and EU privacy shield for data has been struck down by the courts. I will see if I can get an interview with Kevin Cahill about this last week. But today, the courts have said that there will be no more exchange of data by the big tech companies between Britain and America, the transatlantic anymore. So this is a major blow, of course, for the big tech companies. I would imagine, though, that they may have got all their data moved around as much as possible before today. And I would think that there's also going to be compensation to pay for data that has been illegally moved.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. And it would be interesting to see what Kevin's got to say about it, because the point he was making is that the misuse of data by the tech companies on behalf of the NSA, for example, means that you can't sue the government. There's no possibility. But the tech companies themselves, they can be sued. And you can have something like the payment protection scam, where they all get with the banks, where if everybody sues them for $3,000 apiece for misuse of data, you could possibly bankrupt them.
Well, let's finish on a bit of good news, though. I say finish. We're going to be back after the music. But no DSS letting bans were ruled unlawful this week by the courts. The judges ruled bans on renting properties to people on housing benefit are unlawful. A momentous court ruling. That's a momentous, according to the charity Shelter. Found a single mum experienced discrimination when a letting agent refused to rent to her. So this actually could make some, particularly for people who go through letting agencies, Martin, make an enormous difference.
It could, but I have to tell you that they've got all kinds of ways of making sure that they don't take people on universal credit. That's been the main cause of the increase in homelessness since it was brought in. Basically, private landlords will not rent to people on universal credit. And one of the biggest private landlords in the country, who's a big Tory party donor, said, we're going to kick out our existing tenants if you bring this in, and we're going to bring in East Europeans who are in work and can pay the rent. So this has always been an issue. It was flagged up to Ian Duncan Smith from the get-go of the universal credit, but he just ignored it. And now we've got a homelessness crisis virtually entirely caused by the government and its regulations.
Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.